Hello and welcome to episode 14 of Rethinking Work. We have been looking at cities over this series, and I think we've looked a lot around different cities, but today we're focusing on London. We went over to Lee Bofkins, Global Street Art Studio. He's the co-founder, started it 10 years ago. And I think the thing that blew us away is the transformational ability that art can have on cities. And we really go into depth about how he's grown this enormous company. Chances are any huge, and I do mean huge billboard you've seen paint on the side of buildings in and around cities, not just London, but around the country, will have been through Global Street Art. I mean, where did we go? Where was the studio?
It was underneath Telephone House by Old Street.
It was incredible, wasn't it? I think we both loved the Aladdin Cave.
Oh, I mean, it's the fantasy. If you're into art and architecture, you go and it's a kind of huge Batman cave of artist equipment. And it felt a bit like Fight Club, didn't it?
Yeah.
Where they were getting ready to do sort of special ops and interventions from their basement. But he was really inspiring, and he's got all these amazing collections of cigarette cards and matchboxes and old tattoo books. And it was a real sort of archive, which I hadn't appreciated. So Lee is also trying to grow this kind of gallery of inspiration as much as actually do the art. So yeah, we came away so inspired, and I hope you'll enjoy it too.
Yeah, so they're about, I think, 30 people now, just this crew of artists. And what Bill's referring to is, as we were going there, they were ready to go out with like backpacks full. And he sort of legalized and celebrated street art. Anyway, it's brilliant. Go on the website at globalstreetart.com. They've got hundreds of thousands of Instagram followers. We're Able Partners. Go on our website, ablepartners.co.uk, or find us on Instagram at able_partners. Enjoy. We are now recording.
Okay.
Welcome to Rethinking Work. What I wanted to quickly paint for you, this is the second series, and we're focusing, first series is all about work, and the second series is all about cities. So fast forward to what, 3 weeks ago, mm-hmm. I saw you doing a talk at Savills,
yeah.
And I was blown away. And I'll admit I'd seen a lot of your work, but you, Lee, are the founder of Global Street Art. So many people will have seen some of your work around London,
yeah,
and a lot of cities.
Yeah.
But I just thought, one of the reasons I'm excited to talk to you, I just saw this huge thing on Instagram recently, all about AI art, digital everything. And
yeah,
I think people are becoming particularly maybe bored or oversaturated with digital art. And part of, I think, the success of yours is it's very analog. People go and they see it and they see the paint and the making of it. And I'd imagine people are responding more and more to that. I mean, your Instagram following is what, 350,000 people or whatever?
Yeah, something like that.
It's massive. I mean, you have huge outreach, but why don't you explain to us what Global Street Art is?
Ooh, start with the big questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Global Street Art was founded with a mission to live in painted cities. It's about 10 years ago or so now. I'm one of the co-founders. We started it by accident. There was no real business plan at the start. But we had the mission. We had a grand mission. Today, Global Street Art is known for a few things. We're, as you pointed out, we evangelize. We talk about street art online. We have a large online following, and that's just promoting street art and artists around the world and showing great examples from anywhere. The second side of what we do is our community side. Since 2012, we've organized over 2,500 legal street art murals across London. We have a couple of flagship programs within that, including Art for Estates, that's painted around 200 murals in housing estates, no cost to councils, no cost to residents, and also building sites, SIGHDS. Obviously, it's a pun based on building sites, but that works on construction hoardings. So we work with property developers, scores points for the Considerate Constructor Scheme and site appearance and community integration. But, you know, turns a boring construction hoarding into basically a rotating gallery over time. And then we have London Mural Festival that's fit within that. We've organized other street art festivals as well.
You've organized that? That's your
London Mural Festival is a Global Street Art. We organized it. Yeah, absolutely. And that happened. That went really well. 75 murals, working with 200 artists in 13 different London boroughs. There were so few good news stories during COVID that the fact a festival of some kind could carry on, and it was socially distanced because it was outside and it was someone up in a lift, and then you go and see it in your own time because we published a map and it became part of people's cycle routes. It was really nice, really wonderful thing to do, but it nearly killed us. It was exhausting. It was wonderful. So we said we'd do it every 4 years. So the next one, fingers crossed.
Yeah, like the Olympics.
Exactly that. Just you couldn't do it every year. 2024. And then the third side of what people know us for is our commercial stuff. So far and away, the UK's leading company for hand-painted advertising. We have roughly we have our own portfolio of walls all around the UK that we sell to key clients. And then we paint their designs, but also design in-house and capture all the digital content in-house associated with that. And that becomes an end-to-end solution for those kind of clients. And then we also work for property developers too. It's a smaller part of our business, but it's a brilliant part of our business. It includes interiors and fit outs, but it's also very large scale outdoor walls. Sometimes we design them, sometimes we're given the design, but we enjoy them both, but they tend to be longer lasting. And that's kind of satisfying as well.
And are you a group? So you work with artists and you also have in-house artists.
Yeah.
So you can do everything in-house, but then you might, does everything go through you for the artist, or do you outsource this to other artists?
It depends on the project, right? And what the outcome a client wants to achieve. So we design in-house because there's an efficiency that goes with that. We know what, you know, how to work with different types of clients to do that. And we have a brilliant in-house team. But for some projects where a client wants a specific style, will act like an illustration agent, or where they want an artist who's an influencer or has a bigger following, in their own right, will act like an influencer, you know, agency. So it runs the gamut. Like every artwork we get is different. So every project is slightly different. And we get some crazy requests. On Friday, we had a call from a PR company, said White Claw would like to do a cooling mural. Is there such a thing as cooling paint? And I'm like, well, not really, but we do, you know, my dog is laying by my feet, his paintbrush. She sleeps on cooling pads if it's really hot. So you can get these gel cooling pads from Amazon. So we said, well, we can apply those to a wall. Demonstrably, they work. They do remove heat. It's not going to be ice cold, but it's going to be cooler than the surrounding environment. Yeah, go ahead and do that. So we designed it in an hour on Friday afternoon, a couple of hours on Friday afternoon, painted it on Monday. It went to press on Tuesday morning. It was in the Mirror, the Express, the Sun, a few other publications. That was yesterday. And actually, we've done some really fun projects that press have really gotten a hold of recently as well. We did a beautiful ball court in Lambeth for European Cricket Board and Sky. So we transformed in a housing estate, the ball court.
So in this talk, when I saw you for the first time 3 weeks ago, I couldn't believe the amount of work you were doing, the scale of what you were doing. And I was saying to Bill, and I put this in my pitch to you in the email, I looked at your job and I was like, I think that's the coolest job. Just the way that to give people an idea of scale, you've done these huge 100-meter tall side of a tower building, incredible works of art that must take people weeks to spray paint and do. They're massive, and you work with Nike, you work with all these amazing brands.
Yeah, we've worked with some really amazing brands, but we're specialists at what we do. So if you want to get advice over doing something that's quite technically difficult, that's how we found, we know our materials really well. We know how long it takes to paint. We're really good at putting together teams of artists to deliver large, complicated murals, which Chaz approved. So the health and safety is there, the insurance limits there, all of those things that you don't want to have to think about that could become a headache. Well, over time, we've grown the ability to do all that stuff. And it is a lot of fun. I absolutely love my job to bits. Yeah. I love who I get to work with every day. I can't see why I'd ever want to change
that. It's funny you say that, because I did notice that change. I grew up in kind of North and East London, and suddenly the street artists had mupes and high-vis jackets and cones. And I was thinking, hang on, at what stage did everyone stop doing this at 2 a.m? And
Still happens, right? It all still happens. And whatever we do, that stuff at 2 a.m. is going to happen anyway, you know?
I'm painting it very generally. You've kind of legalized what I would imagine most people see as an illegal art form, which is spraying on creative art.
I'm so much more careful with words, right? So we've helped support a culture which deserve more spaces to paint with permission. At the same time, London has lost quite a lot of legal walls where you can just turn up and paint at any time. So there has to be a thought and a campaign for trying to improve that as well. You know, the interaction between what we do and the illegal stuff, they're really quite separate. Some people might be involved in both sort of cultures. And, you know, if you want to know someone that can paint really quickly, they've probably at least painted illegally at some point in their life, right? But
that's interesting, that kind of idea of those spaces not being available. I mean, we do a bit of work with the Dream Factory, and they're just moving into
absolutely.
The Black House. And, you know, they've coloured that. That is a blank canvas. And it has huge popular support.
Absolutely.
People love that it's the changing dynamic. And actually, it's cheap, it's available, the planners don't seem too hung up on it. But actually, there probably isn't enough neutral space for this.
I mean, and I'm not sure that we necessarily provide all of the solutions for that, nor should we, right? We're sort of curators in a very loose
sense.
But
I mean, we're architects.
Right.
You know, should that be part of the briefing and our conversations with planning is that actually we pick our materials very carefully. Again, it's like, it's about longevity, it's about maintenance, it's about aesthetics, it's about all of that stuff. But it's really never occurred to me to leave bits of an estate
absolutely
available for different interpretation by artists. I don't know if you've...
Yeah, no, well, I think the reason I was so drawn to it, and I think it's amazing, because we were on Goode Street today, just off Goode Street, a co-working space you work at, and they've got this enormous mural right on a square.
Whitfield Gardens.
Yeah,
we did that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, we restored that for Camden Council 2 years ago.
There you go.
Ben saw a man performing a sex act at lunchtime in the Whitfield Gardens.
Yes, it has many different uses depending on
I mean, it's a multi-use space.
I had my lunch there. He had fun. I was fine.
Great.
But the difference, the sense of...
I love that. That's London through and through.
Yeah.
And it humbles you. It really doesn't matter how beautiful the mural you've just painted is or what you've just avoided. You will probably step back in a boo.
Yeah. Or be attacked by a pigeon.
Is it worth as well just giving a flavour of where we're sitting? So we're in East London, in Lee's studio, the home of Global Street Art. And it is a kind of Aladdin's Cave fantasy art studio.
He's come in drooling with inspiration.
He took us into what looks like a bank vault. That's an enormous caged room with maybe, you know, 10,000 different colours spray paint. Now, there's about 50 grand worth of pens in a huge locker next to me. I mean, there's people
for anyone that's listening, it's about £100 worth of pens and 10 spray.
Yeah. I'm not going to give the direct name, the exact location, but it is a complete fantasy. Oh, like a boy's own collection. And could you mention some of your collections briefly. I think that sort of depth of thought to this organization is one of the things that people might not immediately understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the mission is to live in painted cities, but the reason to do it is to inspire. So, and it's that simple, that at the end of this, when my career is over and we all move on and do different things, hopefully this lasts beyond me, beyond us, beyond the people that are here now, and leave something that's inspiring. And the idea of collecting different facets of visual culture and being able to show and inspire and influence artists and then have them come in, do residencies and produce something that they wouldn't have thought of that might help put them in a different direction. Well, if you can help influence and inspire artists, they go on to influence, inspire other people. So it's such a privilege to be able to be someone who has an opportunity, and we're not anywhere fully there yet, but the opportunity to work with and hopefully inspire artists who then go on and inspire everyone else. And each other, right? And it's so interesting to me what you said about architecture before, because architects produce something that you want to last. It's the statement piece. But cities don't work like that. They change a lot over time. Most of the places we've ever been able to get permission for were because they were trashed, or someone didn't look after it, or it was, you know, tagged anyway, or it was just an unloved space. That's great for us. And we are so used to seeing spaces change over time that architecture, partly because maintenance costs, teaches you or leads you into more likely to think of producing something that's there to last. Maybe it lasts 30 years, maybe it lasts 1,000 years, but that's what's going there. But cities and then how they're used change those spaces, and people use those spaces. We model them better now than we ever did, but people will still use your space in ways that you didn't imagine. And having an allowance for that change over time, for changing tastes and changing aesthetics, which could just be the color or how it's, you know, and how it's painted, or having some spaces that could be painted and changing over time.
But you know,
it's
that
a different
thing
way to think about it.
Totally. And also paint. Isn't paint amazing? I think those whitewashed houses, whether that you're talking about the Shetland Islands or painted wooden houses in Canada, you can refresh it every couple of years, but we don't really suggest painted buildings as a solution anymore, you know.
And I find that quite interesting because I know what the cost of cladding is, you know, and I'm not making like references to flammable cladding in Grenfell. I just mean the economic cost to clad a building is very, very high. And, you know, that's a certain aesthetic, but, you know, I think we don't capture the use of paint brilliantly over history. Like in ancient Egypt, all houses were painted. You know, when you look at mosaics and you go to Rome, you look at mosaics, that prevalence of art, at the point we've, you know, society has had enough breathing room and we're not at war and we're settled, we generally make our spaces nicer. You know, people have, if you have the time to do it, you improve your own space. We're kind of seeing that we're almost like retrofitting cities now. We're using rooftops of big box buildings and small homes for solar panels. You know, this isn't something that you could have planned at the start. And I think that's something that's fun about architecture as well, is a lot of things are going to happen that you can't plan for. You don't know, you know, the, you might have some ideas for the future, but you're never going to get it exactly right. So some changes are going to happen after time anyway. And it's quite nice. It's so fun that you can change the way people feel about a building by changing the way the building looks. Yeah. And we can do that fairly quickly. And it's not that expensive.
Well, that's what's so interesting. So Bill mentioned the dirty house, the Shoreditch house. The thing, like the Shoreditch building, which was designed specifically to be a blank canvas to be painted.
Mm.
That area is so cool because every time I go there, it looks different. I go down the same street and the windows stay in the same location, but it could have an enormous face on it. Could be some sort of camouflage paint.
Yeah.
It's so exciting to go down there, and that overlap of art and buildings is really exciting in that specific
it's
area.
Also, you say we don't know what's going to happen. Well, you know, COVID came. We didn't know what was going to happen. We're in the process of refitting out a lot of offices, which no longer need rows of desks.
Yeah.
But also, it's not just desks. It's the environment needs to feel more cultural. It needs to feel more like home. It needs to feel more like a neighborhood. And murals are a quick win. But I'm almost thinking, what are the other mediums? Whether, you know, are we talking about huge quilts or, you know, things that go into the ceiling? I mean, I'm thinking of all these other mediums that global street art could capture or evolve into, or is that not?
I think because the mission is to live in painted cities, and the artists that we work with, we're really, you know, paint and that kind of art focused. But when someone comes along and says, look, do you know someone who can do this or do that? Well, it kind of depends. We take it on a case by case basis. We could. I think there's a liberation in being fairly focused. I don't want us to become an agency that does absolutely everything on an advertising point of view, nor does everything for property developers, like, you know, fit outs, etc., just because we've got a relationship and we're trusted. I'd rather that someone who, for whom that was their passion, they were the people doing it, because I know what I'm enthusiastic about and what we're inspired by. And I think, you know, the more we do of that, we do that really well.
Yeah. And so I sort of mistakenly assumed you had a background as an artist. So could you tell us a little bit about the genesis and your interest in this?
I think immediately you've called it Genesis, which has just made it way fancier than it was. I'm here like everyone by accident. So I guess my original background, I was a scientist. I'm a doctor, I have a PhD in maths and evolution. I finished when I was about 25, 26. And I really didn't know what I want to do, right? What I wanted to do. At the same time, I grew up in North London in a small town on the edge of an IKEA. It was inherently really boring. I learned to break dance in the lounge badly. But then I really got into it. And then I started traveling for it. I went to classes, joined a crew, started a crew, those kind of things. And so I was at one point, this was before it was that popular, but in the early 2000s, I was representing the UK, dancing with Soul Mavericks, my crew at the time, who still come to our office and train some Mondays, just because we've got the space for it. And I've always kept connected with that subculture. And I was just, I was a dancer. I was really enjoying it. I loved hip hop music. I loved that culture. It got me out of Radlett, which is a commuter town now, but was a farm basically at the time. It was very boring. And because of that, I got to travel, I got to meet people, and I used to just casually, because if you go to a place like Germany, and especially at the time, all the youth clubs, the graffiti came at the same time as the dancing. So you'd go inside and dance, but they'd have the graffiti on the outside walls, because hip hop was this packaged culture that came at you like. So I started casually, as I was photographing us, the dancers, I was photographing graffiti. And then in dancing, I picked up an injury, hurt my knee, I had to stop dancing overnight. I just got into photographing graffiti more and more. After science, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew that as you mature in science, you spend more time applying for money and less time doing the fun stuff, which is the actual science. The, you know, the logic at the time was, well, maybe I should understand business, something else, you know, understand a bit more about these other things of society. I've done life. Let's do the money thing. Let's understand that. So I joined an American finance company, met Conrad, my business partner, our co-founder. This was his idea, not mine. But for a period of time, we bought a nice camera. I could, while I was traveling for work anyway and doing the finance stuff, where I was living in different cities and countries every once in a while, I was photographing graffiti prolifically. And then we started a company, again, Conrad's idea, not mine. And I built up an archive of 50,000 photos in 25 countries. And then because I come from a biology, taxonomy, phylogeny background, started classifying the graffiti I was seeing by all sorts of categories and basically built like a mini Getty Images, but just for graffiti. Well, I was amazed at how good it was. And at the time, Flickr was taking off, but it was before Instagram. Street art was nowhere near as popular as it is now. And the graffiti side of it, by graffiti, I mean like people that, yeah, this, the more the subculture than the art form or even the crime, but there were lots of people painting in like city rivers in Spain, and the characters were amazing. The letters were amazing. The colors were amazing, but not many people were seeing it. And it just didn't make sense to me. And I think there was something about it that where other people don't appreciate something, there's like a, it's not even a sense of justice, but I wanted people to see it. Like I believed in it. I was like, this is cool. Why does no one know this? And I'm definitely not always right on that, but that's goes to the things that I collect now.
You know, when you go traveling with someone who's lived there and they explain to you the history, they guide you through that space.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing that with this art form. You know, you're showing people and guiding people through the history of it. I mean, when we came in, you've got collections.
Well, I was going to say that I'm really interested to hear that about your science background, because before we came on air, Lee was showing us his beautiful collections of cigarette cards.
Razor blade wrappers.
Or sort of legacy, like vinyl wrappers, postcards, and they're categorized and they're thorough. And it almost feels like the British Museum of Street Art. And I think your sort of scientific background comes through.
That's the extension, right? So think about what street art is, right? It's you can get, there's so many different stuff outside, and artists are influenced by so many different things, that street art is just all of this stuff that's outside, that's appropriated, borrowed from, and remixed all of this history of visual culture. And graffiti's not that, but it's also out there at the same time anyway. So if you want to work with street artists and you're interested in what they're painting, you're kind of interested in everything. And I'm interested in how our use of images has changed in the last 100-150 years with lithographic printing. You know, we've reduced the cost to publish images, but with that we've reduced the appreciation. And it's something I only really realized or thought of, it's obvious when you say it, but it hit home quite a lot recently, that if there isn't a cost associated with something, you don't appreciate it as much. And that's it. So there's a lot of stuff that, like, it's free, it's online, you go to experiential stuff, you appreciate the festival that you paid £100 ticket, but someone gave you the free ticket, I might skip it, I don't care. But there was a cost associated with publishing images and sharing images and posting images, literally through the post with the cost of a stamp. All of that's gone now. So we use images and we see so many images because there's no publishing cost and no sharing cost. So the appreciation of how that image is formed, the design behind it, the messaging that goes with that, I don't know if it's shrunk. I don't think it probably has. I think we've got it and it's innate, but it's not necessarily the most common of conversation topics.
Is there a value? I mean, they sort of call it the IKEA effect, that you assign something more value if you've had an input in its creation, if you kind of build something. I wonder, you know, when you travel around India and a blockbuster movie's come out and they've hand-painted the movie star you know, on the side of the cinema, it is staggering. You know, it has a much bigger impact on, you know, on me than seeing just a printed poster. And I wonder if that's sort of a bit of the texture of...
I think the thing that's happening behind that is the effort and the skill of the person or people or team that's produced that advert, that poster, right? So you're appreciating craft fundamentally. Whether that was inherent in the design, I think, is probably a separate thing that's going on there, right? But you know, we've got a very large collection of Matchbox labels because people don't smoke anymore. They don't use lighters. They've gone on to vaping. No one cares. Not that many people collect Matchbox labels. They're way out of fashion. But when you look at them, and you look at some of them that are 100 years old and cost pennies each, and then you look at 1,000 of them and realize how beautiful the design was, and that they were printed lithographically, how were they set, they were in multiple layers, whatever that process was that produced them, but the design thinking behind it, they're very beautiful small objects. And unless someone, you know, stops you and basically says, look, here's one, you're not going to be that interested, here's 100, here's 1,000, this is beautiful. And then all of a sudden, you know, sometimes we'll collect new collections, or we'll start new collections, And one of the most common feedbacks is, oh yeah, that's cool. I didn't realize that was cool. And I-
That's exactly my response.
Yeah, it's just like, oh wow, I didn't realize that, you haven't seen this one, but like vintage paper bags that were screen printed are really cool. But they are. And when you see one of them, you're like, okay, that's kind of cool. But when you see like the Percy Daltons, and that's got a Hackney Wick history for the peanut factory. But when you see the Percy Daltons, this is so obscure, peanut bag, roasted peanut bag, and you've got the Nutty is the name of the character giving the finger, literally, at all of the other peanut brands. You're like, all right, that is cool. And then you see the address was just around the corner then from where the office is now, you've got a connection to it. And there's 1,000 examples, 1,000 examples like that, just next door on a few shelves, that we want to give people, especially artists to start, access to those things because they trigger feelings.
Well, you really kind of made my brain whir when we came in, because I thought you just did like wall art, and then suddenly you showed us all these collections and the scales were so different. You were like, oh, I've got these old razor blade packaging and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you said, well, if you look at one of our murals on our phones, it's the same size as the packaging for a Maxbox.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, you've just collected all these different scales. And and suddenly I understand the lineage between why you would collect postcards, stamps, packaging, bags, because essentially they're all just different canvases at different scales.
They're slightly different proportions. And the scale means that you use different skills to paint them, to complete them. But there's a commonality between them. And what's interesting to me is how artists that would have worked 50 years ago, 100 years ago in one medium were also producing Matchbox labels and giant watercolors and, Christmas books for kids, et cetera, et cetera. And now I think, as design is formalized more, you're more likely to be just a packaging designer that works on a certain kind of retouching of a certain kind of package and the kerning for this Coca-Cola product, because there's so much thought and effort into that, but we're more likely to be kind of pigeonholed.
Can I ask a technical question that everyone that I've spoken to about telling you who I'm interviewing, they've gone, how do you make an enormous mural so accurate? Like, technically, how does that work? Because I think people think you do it freehand, but you don't. You don't do it with projection.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Well, no, I mean, there's like 4 or 5 ways that you can scale up. You're asking basically, how do you take a small design and make it onto a big wall? Yeah. You can raw sketch it. And then you look at your sketch, you refine your sketch, and then you fill in when you're happy with the sketch. There's ways that you can do that. There's ways that you can do that freehand and ways you can do it a bit more formally. There's a fun way called squiggle gridding, where you just make a mess on the wall and then you overlay the image on your phone, usually using a program like Snapseed. You overlay the image on the squiggles and then you're like, okay, with translucency, this nose, the edge of the nose goes over that squiggle, the eye goes over that squiggle. And it's one way of translating an image because you've got a lot of noise in the background that you're putting your clear image over the top. So that's one way of doing it. Okay. Gridding is another way. It's another way of scaling up. I've got a grid on my paper. I put the same grid on the wall. I paint square by square. Another way is projections. We used to use that a lot, but it only works at night, which doesn't help in summer. And you can't use it if you're accessing by scaffold. But there is an appropriate place for that as well. Another method that we use quite a lot, but not all the time, is called pouncing, where you essentially take the line drawing of the artwork, you print it on strips of paper that are perforated and scored in a special way. And then think of it as using a stencil to make your sketch. So if you hold your paper, your stencils essentially up to the wall and spray through them, you get the perfect line drawing, and then it's essentially paint by numbers, but a lot more complicated than that. But that's it. All of this, as I mentioned before, whatever your drawings say or whatever art you're making, you're going to get your sketch on first, and then you get your sketch right, and then you fill it in. If that's an ink drawing or it's a gouache or whatever, you get your sketch first. So that's how we do it.
Bloody hell, that sounds... I mean, what's the longest it takes to do? Like, is it weeks or is it you do it in a matter of days?
Most of our commercial murals take 3 to 5 days. We work with teams who are pretty efficient and effective, and we've got a good harmony of working together. We've had some projects that have paint times that are multiple weeks. We helped an artist, Ben Ein, in a project that was supported by Zippo, the lighter company, in Hackney Wick, near here east, on a place that's been built over by East Wick and Sweetwater. That was about 17,500 square meters with a team of 30, up to roughly 30, and that was 6 tons of paint. That took a good few weeks. But the logistics at that scale are just completely different.
And this is all you organizing it. You're the guy that
you're giving me far too much credit, and it's lovely, and I wish it was me, but it isn't. We're a team of about 25 people full time, plus another set of. We also have a group of retained artists that we just work with those guys as well on a freelance basis, but we guarantee them a minimum income. We cover a lot of functions here, so we've got two brilliant planning people, three amazing designers, a team of three that captures content, and they do it beautifully. We've got lots of unsung heroes in operations, two lead artists, a workshop manager and workshop support. We've got a team of four in client service. We don't have any salespeople, funnily enough. It feels a bit irresponsible, so we've taken on a team of two to do that, who are going to start soon. But for years and years, we haven't had anyone that did outreach and sales. You know, I haven't done a podcast for 2 years.
Well,
I don't know,
sales is an interesting thing.
Change that question.
Well, we don't generally, in architecture, you can have people that do business development, but actually, you want to talk to the technical expert. You want to talk to the architects. There's not a sales team. I can see, you know, talking to you and the experts, it's kind of pulls out of you. And I think that's like reassuring. And that's what clients want to hear rather than a polished pitch about your portfolio. But I just wonder if there's like, what can we do as designers of cities to make more of this medium? And or is it? It's nice that it's changing abandoned spaces. You know, I'm thinking of creating neutral spaces that are designed to have a rolling program of art.
Yes.
You know, I've actually never seen that. Right. I've only seen it sort of retrospectively allowed. And I think maybe we should do something a bit more assertive.
It turns the blank face of a building suddenly into potentially one of the most interesting facades of the building, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Well, when Graham Hussey was taking that house, the fact that he could do what he wanted on the wall was a key driver.
Yeah.
And it just strikes me as a missed opportunity to say, actually, the planning constraint is you can't do anything on this wall, but on these three walls, you can do what you want. I mean, we'd love to take that as a studio. I mean, imagine if you took a building where you had a free...
I mean, I would like to do it as a neighborhood more than a building. Mm-hmm. I think the impact of it is cumulative. So we've got wonderful walls around the office. And if you saw one piece of art on the wall, it would give a certain impression. But because there's so much art here, it gives a different impression. And it's not appropriate that every part of every city should be that, you know, raucous with color. But there's certainly opportunities. And I don't think there's very few places I can think of anywhere around the world where there's so much art in such a concentrated space. What's beautiful about having a space like that is not architects, but placemakers and certainly developers now talk a lot about making communities. Mm. You don't. You facilitate them. You can't make one, but you can make things easier and the barrier to entry much lower from people that want to do this stuff anyway or are doing it, but may be struggling. So creating like... a district of walls that is kept clean, that, you know, is like, it's funny that I go kept clean, but it's like, so that it's easy to dispose of the litter. There's a paint shop nearby that doesn't, you know, that is reasonably priced. There are, you know, when you have a place that, like that, that's got some of the support and the facility around it, you can pay between this hour and this hour, or it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, and the lighting is great. Well, then someone's probably always going to be painting there, and then people won't feel so bad about walking home at night there, you know. You don't make a community, but you can... It's some communities, and I think a lot of subcultures in London, it's certainly not just painting, but dance is another one that I know really well. It is there's so little funding, certainly that comes from the government, but there's so little private funding that goes in that if we're here saying something, it's a testament to the fact that there's a lot of amazing artists in London around the world that want to paint. There's certainly an appetite for more painting than there is right now. We've been pretty good at helping that conversation in the middle. And so for the sake of maybe 5-10 minutes of our time, it might facilitate an artist to spend 2 days, 3 days doing something beautiful in a housing estate that they want to do because that's their memory of London, or they care about their neighborhood, or for whatever reason, that then looks beautiful for some number of years. So there's that small amount of resource applied can have that knock-on impact. Well,
it's interesting. We used to live in Alexandra Palace, and there's a skate park.
Like, I know it well.
Yeah, and they all spray paint. There's like a wall that is always being spray painted. And the it's such an odd, I'm there with my kids. They allowed my kid to do a bit of spraying at the bottom. Mm-hmm. He thought it was really cool. Mm. All the parents taking photos. It completely lost any sort of illegal feel, and it was actively encouraging the spots of paint everywhere and so many people taking photos. And it's like, if you just curate it and manage it in the right way.
Do you know what's really funny? How big is that wall?
Yeah.
If you had to estimate, what, 6-7 meters wide?
Yeah.
3 meters high max? Is one of very few places you can do that, especially in that part of town. And yet, that's where kids first hold their spray can. That's where parents realize, oh, it's not so illegal. Yeah. Or, you know, I'm going to hang out there. Or let's just do a detour of 20 meters and go past the skate park because I want to show you and see if someone's painting. It's so underinvested that I don't think art ever needs to hold its hand out and beg. And I really take objection to that idea. I think it's genuinely valuable, and you can show economically, unfortunately as well, but culturally certainly. And I say unfortunately because I don't want to be so reductive that I'm only saying we should make these decisions for economic reasons, because that's not what I'm saying. But with that economic power, you know, funding the arts a little bit more, you can have such an outsized impact. And people that do that and invest in that and take it seriously, like Quintain, for example, as a good example of what they've done in Wembley, it has an outsized impact. And it's talked about in press, it's shared on social media. And all of a sudden, Wembley is not just Wembley Stadium, it's Wembley Park, it's the area around. They're doing these cool events. Let's, you know, and it's also Wembley Arena, but there's more to it. And then it's attractive for a box park to form that, to be there. And then it's attractive for other retailers to be there as well.
I mean, we're coming up to the kind of 40 minute mark, and I know you were super busy. I guess I wanted to end on, is this is obviously so popular in London, but you work in cities and
I don't think it is at all.
Oh really?
No, I mean, I think it's popular on social media. I think it's increased in its popularity, but even around Shoreditch there's plenty of unpainted walls. We don't have neighborhoods that are like walls to wall of color. If you go to parts of like South America, if it's Brazil, Colombia, you know, you'll see what it can look like and how beautiful it can be to have really solid, dense areas of painting. That's not to say that it's not popular in London, but there's a common mistake I think people make when they say, oh, it's saturated. Is it? Come on, like, we've got what percentage of walls in London are painted? One?
Yeah, way less than that even.
Right.
Yeah.
So you really notice when you walk past, you know, that shortcut on the way through the W Hotel, you know, you really notice when you see a piece of street art. I mean, you do see the tools kind of going around on Sunday, but I agree, it could be much more.
Yeah. And I think, you know, then think about other cities and towns and smaller places in the UK. Some have got amazing small street art scenes because one person lives there or two people live there and they've brought their friends over years. And wow, you're a really well-known street artist and you live in Nuneaton. And every once in a while, someone comes and stays with you and I've got my five spots that I'm friends with the local cafe owners. And now Nuneaton has a street art scene. That's a specific example.
Yeah.
But you can get that anywhere. And it's often a very small number of people can have an outsized impact in how much street art is there and is painted.
Well, that's a pause point for optimism, isn't it? That actually you can have a seed, you can have one kind of kernel of creativity and can change a suburban commuter town into something special.
It's optimistic and it comes with a warning because, you know, and ultimately culture is fragile. When you take away the nightclubs in Soho, you take away a lot of the soul of Soho, right? These are obvious examples. Like, I understand you can't let buildings atrophy you, but when you don't plan to keep Denmark Street, or you don't plan to keep Walker's Court and the nightclubs and the, you know, disco and all of the things that, and so those places often just dissipate, right? Those communities and cultures don't find other places. They'll find shared places online. There's nights, people can travel, but it isn't the same and it's never going to be the same. The change is going to be the same, but culture is fragile. And so with a little support, you can do a lot, but because it's often so fragile, when that support is taken away, well, you can lose something. I should have said it the other way around, because really what I'm saying is give it that little bit of support and you'll be... I'm not even talking about advocating for street art, but any of those cultures, any cultures.
Well, I guess I've been trying to really rack my brains why I was so drawn to this medium. And I think, you know, Bill and I, we do these big buildings, but they can take 5-10 years. You just said someone rang you on Friday. You had an idea by the end of Friday. By Monday, you'd done a cool thing. And by Tuesday, it's in the press. There's something about the immediacy of the feedback of this medium. It's so exciting.
Just get it done. And then someone tags over it on a Friday and you say, well,
fine.
That's part of the...
Fine. No, it's got, that wall's gone today. Because it was done for a press PR thing. So actually, when you met Dan, who was walking in not so long ago, he's removing that mural now. Sometimes it's there for, you know, and we're not so precious over it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but there's so many other ways that we could invest in and support culture as well.
I'll wrap this up, but what are you doing next? Because Bill and I kind of said, this feels like a little V&A gallery of street art. Is this the, you had a mission and a goal of 2035, you were telling us on the way in.
Yeah.
What is it to catalogue and create a gallery space? Because
gallery space undersells it. So there is a museum idea that runs. I mean, so what we've said is by 2035, we want to be the global hub for artistic inspiration. That needs a reference library, a resource library, but it also needs things we don't have right now, which are including display. I'm not looking to partner with people on that specifically right now, but opportunities will come up. But, you know, given a little bit of space and some time, I'm sure we can do some pretty fun things.
So there is a big mission.
I mean, there's a huge mission to live in painted cities, but it was chosen because it's impossible. There's no end goal. I'll give you one final story, yeah. if I've got a second.
Yeah.
I was at a friend's wedding. I was at a business partner's wedding. And I sat next to someone who'd worked in private equity for their whole career. His name was Ashley. And he said, Lee, I can't do the accent.
Do the accent.
Lee, what's your exit strategy? How are you going to leave this? What's your exit strategy? I said, Ashley, I'm going to die.
Yeah, the big exit.
That was it. Yeah. That's it. I'm not looking to sell out or change something like that. This is too fun and too interesting and has too many opportunities to do something else. So carry on for as long as you can.
That is the perfect way to wrap this up. Thank you so much for coming on. Go on Global Street Art and follow them on Instagram because it's so inspiring to see all the art.
And thank you to Paintbrush, who promised to make a noise and has been good as gold.
Quietest Hungarian pumi on the planet right now. She might lose her badge.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys.